greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. And I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight aimed at making us and the government more responsible and more spiritual. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free to, from the United States, 877-876-5227. From Canada, 888-810-8322. Or call direct to 530-876-3222. You know, this show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those nasty old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, you can just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible for the very studly crew at the station archives. And you can read my own blog at howtheneocons stole freedom.blogspot.com. Now this week my blog was titled The Path to 9/11 Leads Through Disney to David Horowitz and to His Neoconning Friends. Sometimes things just connect. That article is about the now infamous propaganda film, Path to 9/11. If you watched it, you might also have caught the lackluster and slightly scary performance by George W. Monday night last. In the article, I lay out some little-known history that links the film with both the neocons and a certain faction of libertarianism. It clarifies relationships in ways that will probably amuse and surprise you, making it much more understandable. If you have time, do go read it. Much will be explained that in light of our ongoing story from Hart Williams brings on one of those lovely aha moments we all enjoy so very, very, very much. And now, a very exciting update from New York. This last Tuesday, the primary election was held in New York, and our favorite senator of the slap in New York, Ada Smith, experienced a moment of enlightenment herself. The longtime senator was evidently defeated by a challenger, a local activist. This article appeared just yesterday in the Queen's Chronicle. It is titled, Insurgent Claims Leap Against Senator Ada Smith, by Christopher Henderson. While hundreds of absentee ballots remain to be counted, it appears that State Senator Ada Smith will soon be out of the job she's held for 18 years. According to unofficial results from the City Board of Elections, District 28, Community Education Council President Shirley Huntley is leading Smith by a count of 5,663 votes to 5,666. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? The senator has not officially conceded, and the results of the election will not be certified until September 20th, when all the paper, military, and absentee ballots are counted. Despite her slim margin, Huntley said she felt very secure on the morning after the election. Yesterday, there were no troops out in the street in support of Smith. When I didn't see them, I knew something was up, she added. Smith has not made herself available for comment since the results were announced. Her campaign manager, Jim Dandereau, referred questions to Smith's consultant, Evan Savansky of the Parkside Group. Savansky declined comment and called to Smith's campaign, and district offices were not answered. Huntley's improbable victory will likely terminate the career of one of the most controversial Queens politicians. After years of sporadic run-ins with law enforcement and staffers, Smith made headlines repeatedly in 2006. In August, an Albany City Court judge convicted Smith of harassment, a violation for tossing coffee in the eyes of staffer Jennifer Jackson. Smith also faced allegations of unruly behavior on a plane and throwing a phone at another staffer. Albany District Attorney David Soares is reportedly investigating the senator for misusing public funds by paying no-show staffers. St. Albans District Attorney Archie Spanger, widely regarded as one of the power brokers in Southeast Queens politics, said the election was decided in part by all the negative press and bad publicity that former Senator Smith has been collecting. You can point to any one of a dozen situations that may have caused it, he said. So that's the news from New York. And good news it is for doing the right thing. And now, another piece of news that actually impinges on another person in New York, but this time in the Manhattan area. Even more developments in the case of the pig, Edward H. Crane III, Howie and friends from New York. Last week, we learned that the grasping hand of the Howie was extended to legislate from a distance in Montana and other states. Since then, the governor of Montana has thrown down the gauntlet and challenged Howie to a debate. Streaming for that scene, which is deliciously funny, can be viewed at HowieRichExposed.com. Go to the taper gimmick. The film clip is there. Montanans have no doubt about who's going to play fast and loose with their state. Sites are popping up all over the internet right now, some focusing on one state, some on another, several linking it all together, as does the Howie Rich Exposed site. Hart Williams, who's been doing such a wonderful job, is going to be interviewed for a special on television, so you look for that on PBS. Visit his site for the latest on the misdeeds and mangled strategy of this clutch of clueless schemers at hartwilliams.com. More surprising publicity is in the offing, so be looking for that and announcements to be made here. And now our thought for the week ahead. Now, on the spiritual politician, we're not just about outing the bad nasties. We're also about providing insights that help all of us identify appropriate organizing tools for the big tent of humankind that allows all of us to play nicely together. If you've ever tried to organize any group of third graders or your local Libertarian Party chapter, you'll appreciate the difficulties that that can represent. Now, government is just a tool, like we always talk about, that we use to, as we've agreed, to organize ourselves so that we don't hopefully spend too much time bumping into one another. Last week, we heard from Stephen Safranek about his tool for organizing our family relationships outside of government using civil contracts for marriage, full disclosure for our intentions, and mediation when we disagree. His organizing tool is truemarriage.org, and I know that some of you went and looked over what he's doing there. Now, humans need lots of tools for organizing their activities, and our court system is a tool that we use to reduce the cost of disagreeing with each other and to produce disincentives for the bad, nasty kind of behavior that happens all too often. All organizations exist to provide the walls, the floor, and the ceiling for what and how we're going to behave with each other. And that's one of the things we need to keep in mind about organizations. So going back for a moment to the initiative drives and things like U.S. term limits, which are some of the organizations that have been used that Hart Williams is talking about, it's important to remember that we need to be discerning about what the organization is, what it's supposed to be doing, and what it's actually doing. Because all too often, those organizations can be doing things that are very different than we think they are. Even when we think we're paying attention, and even when we're supporting them with our own time and our own dollars. So that's a cautionary note for this week. And now, I'm sorry to tell you that my guest for this week seems to have evaporated into the internet, and I do not know what happened to him. But I am sure that G. Edward Griffin is fine, and that we will be hooking up with him some other time to talk about the exciting things that he has to share with us, which is going to include things about the Federal Reserve, an organization that he's starting, and his fascinating life. But since I don't have that particular guest tonight, instead, what I'm going to do is share something else with you that I've been doing. And that is a book I'm writing. And the book is on a subject that probably seems a little bit different. But it's a book about my best friend when I was little, and that was James Byron Dean. And the book is about what Jimmy taught me when I was growing up, and which is a lot of different things. So I hope you enjoy this. This is the introduction. I'm going to be telling you about somebody, you know, who is really still very special. When someone has been 50 years in the grave, you would think that their memory would fade, like a leaf that has gone through winter and been weathered to gray on the ground. But with Jimmy, it's not like that. No day passes that people all over the world do not think about Jimmy. No day passes that I do not remember lessons Jimmy taught me, too. I understand that to most of the world, Jimmy is an icon for values that exuded sexuality, angst, and rebellion. To me, he was very different. Jimmy was unlike anyone else I have ever known. For me, Jimmy was kind, patient, understanding, and courteous, while at the same time having him visit was like a bolt of lightning roiling through the house, bringing in its wake new energy and excitement. That was true even when he was quiet. There were no contradictions in Jimmy. He bubbled with ideas that sometimes flowed out like lava, but his intensity was focused inward. I never knew what Jimmy would do next, but I knew it would be wonderful. He could always make me laugh, and he could always make me look at things through new eyes, leaving me with perspectives and ideas to ponder when he went away. It might seem strange that Jimmy would build a relationship with a little girl. He was in his early 20s when I first met him over beanie sandwiches. He was in college then, or had just quit. But that is what happened. Jimmy was a very private person. He was polite and courteous to his elders, like my parents. But I know that he had difficulties sometimes talking to people about his own ideas and plans, especially when he was unsure of himself. I saw that happen when he and my mother sat down to talk on occasion, though they talked often. That's not surprising. My mother could be intimidating. She had majored in math at Berkeley in the 20s and 30s when women were not supposed to be sure about balancing a checkbook. She tutored advanced math at the university, including pure projective geometry. I know she was frustrated with the wife of a housewife living in suburban Los Angeles in the 50s. She and my father had 5 children spread out over 16 years, and the details of living ate up her time and starved her of intelligent conversation. Jimmy was a source of that for her. Mother was full of intelligent viewpoints that sometimes left little room for the opinions of others. She had intended to become a professor of math before she married my father. So when Jimmy confided his plans to quit school and go into acting, she was shocked. The idea that an intelligent young man, the child of someone she had liked very well, would throw away his life by becoming an actor contradicted everything she believed. When he first shared that dream with her, she looked at him over the top of her glasses and told him that actors starve and accomplish nothing positive. It was a clash of ideas, experiences, and will. Mother did know some actors, Bill Silvers lived down the street, and Lloyd Bridges lived around the corner with his family. Mr. Bridges was a scoutmaster with my father, but that cut no ice with Mother, and she was not wrong in general. Most actors were unable to support themselves by acting, and Jimmy knew that. That was a hard moment for Jimmy. I saw that on his face. I held my breath for a while, listening for what would come next. But the moment passed. Jimmy wanted to be respected, but he wanted respect for what was true about himself. Jimmy was not interested in any career but the one he had already planned. His own father didn't like it either. Jimmy let Mom think for a while he might change his mind, but I knew that would never happen. I knew Jimmy. Talking to a little girl who listens with fascinated respect is very different than talking to other adults with their own ideas and prejudices. I think Jimmy needed that. I listened carefully to everything he said, and I learned by listening, and then I started asking questions. Jimmy was the first person who talked to me like I could think. I was starved for that. Being treated like a little blonde doll to be stuffed into pink dresses and told to stay clean and brush my hair annoyed me. Once when my dad called me his little sugar plum, I told him very seriously never to call me that again. Dad was surprised and a little hurt, I think. Jimmy was properly respectful of my intelligence. But he and I could also discuss the fairies who I knew lived under the avocado tree in the backyard. Jimmy had little people in his life, too, so he understood. Jimmy has now been in his grave in Fairmount for 50 years. But when I read about him, I know his true story has not yet been told. Part of the story is out there, but Jimmy was a complex person with many aspects. For many people, Jimmy is the personification of honest rebellion and challenge. To me, Jimmy was fairies, laughter, joy, and courage, and sunlight on water. Its sheen disguising the depths beneath that you never quite see. He was the smell of ginger and lemon and new worlds to be explored. He is as alive for me today as he was that first day over beanie sandwiches in the kitchen at our home on Colby Avenue. Jimmy can't come back from the dead, but I'm hoping that by sharing the lessons that Jimmy taught me, that you'll find another side of him. My Jimmy was not angry. He was determined, focused, insightful, intelligent, patient, funny, and kind. People may be many things to the others they encounter through life. Jimmy gave people what they wanted or expected to see in him. He could do that. He was the consummate actor, becoming the character he was portraying. I think he acted for many people, because he needed to do that to get the parts he desperately wanted. With me, he didn't need to act. The lessons Jimmy taught me all came from what he said and did. I built my life on them. Looking at the world, using the understanding he provided. When I need courage, I still remember the lessons of Jimmy. We met over beanie sandwiches and laughter. But Jimmy's still with me. And that's the introduction of the book. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you chapter one. If you want to call and you want to talk about Jimmy, I'd be delighted to hear from you. And the telephone number, in case you have forgotten it, because you never know, I know you don't necessarily memorize it, is from the USA, 877-876. 5227 from Canada, 888-810-8322, or you can still call direct to 530-876-3222. Chapter 1, The First Time I Met Jimmy. The first time Jimmy came by that I remember was before I was starting to kindergarten at the little primary school just a few blocks away. That was Mar Vista Elementary School, located in West Los Angeles. My older brother, Cappy, Charles Arthur Pillsbury, was at school that day. Cappy was 4 years older than I was and always aware of his dignity, even then. It was quiet that morning, unusual in our house. With 8 or 9 people in residence in a 3-bedroom house, it was rarely still. My sisters were at school. Carol was still at Venice High School, and then Anne had graduated from Venice and was going to UCLA, majoring in math and working at the university. We were different from the other families on Colby Avenue. Most families were made up of a mom and dad who had been children during the Depression. My parents had raised their first 2 children during the Depression years. Cappy was born right at the end of the war, placing him on the leading edge of the baby boom. But while he and I and our younger brother Stephen were in the generation of the baby boom, my parents looked at the world rather differently than the parents of our friends. Most of the fathers on the street were veterans. My father had been too old to serve in World War II and just slightly too young for World War I. When there were differences in how you look at the world, you don't necessarily notice them until you bump your nose on something. There was quite a bit of bumping. We weren't entirely different, of course. About the half the families on the street had a parent who worked at UCLA, like Father. Most of the rest were in some other kind of business, like the family at the corner who ran a bakery, or the Brews. The Brews lived right next to John and Nell Wooden. Their kids were the same age as Ann and Carol. John Wooden also worked at UCLA, coaching basketball. Mrs. Brew worked for Steve Allen, who was an actor. She kept him organized, she said. We had differences inside the family, too. Ann and Carol could not have been less alike, and this had been evident since they were very small. Even though their last names were both Pillsbury, not the most common last name, no one at Venice High School would believe they were related. Ann was tall and very skinny, with dark hair and intense eyes. She was unconcerned about questions of fashion, wearing clothes that would have suited a woman of mature years. That's what Mother said, always trying to get her to try something more appealing. Anne always looked sensible. She said she liked looking sensible. Today, you would say she was a nerd. She focused completely on her schoolwork, which was mostly math, when I could remember, and on helping Mother around the house. When she graduated, she became a mathematician for GE and an early computer programmer. Anne's side of the room she shared with Carol was always immaculate. Her clothes were always clean and pressed and hung in the closet with precisely 1/4 of an inch between the hangers. This changed when she had children of her own. Anne made all of the presents she gave us at Christmas or for our birthdays herself. Thrift is a virtue, but sometimes her zeal for a real deal was less than optimal consequences. One of her finest finds was a purchase of 100 yards of red and white striped material for just 10 cents a yard. She said she found it at a store that was going out of business. Mom said that if this was an example of their stock, that going out of business was the least of their problems. The stripes were about 1 inch wide, and you had to be careful when you wore a garment made from it because contact with your skin could cause abrasions. From this supply of material, Anne made a seemingly endless stream of objects and garments that were still with some of us in 1994. The material would have worked well as sails on a schooner or as the tarp on a covered wagon making the trek west. I received a full skirt and matching blouse and a jack bag that outlasted the leather one she also made for me. I had to outgrow the blouse and skirt. When we went out together, the circumstance of our wearing these garments sometimes caused us to be mistaken for a troupe of singers, a misconception easy to dispel since none of us could carry a tune. Anne made all of her own clothes, which Mother and Carol agreed would be all right if she used different patterns and material. But Anne had a mind of her own, despite the domesticity of her bent of mind. When we went out together, Anne was usually mistaken for my mother and Mother for my grandmother. Neither of them thought this was very amusing, but everyone else in the family did. For my 3rd birthday, Anne gave me a doll wrapped in a really nice box with a ribbon and a card. But it was a doll. When I had first seen the present wrapped up and sitting on the table with all of the other presents, I had started jumping up and down with excitement. the box had been the right size and shape for a model horse I desperately wanted. So it was hard for me not to show how disappointed I was when I ripped off the paper, pulled off the top, and saw, wrapped in lavender tissue paper, a doll wearing a wedding dress with tiny veil and an equally tiny bouquet of artificial flowers. I gulped and looked up at Anne, waiting in happy anticipation for my reaction. I had pointed out to her a wonderful Palomino horse model with a real saddle and bridle that buckled. They were made from real leather, and when I closed my eyes, I could almost see myself riding a real horse with a saddle just like it, but larger. Anne had taken me to the toy store just the week before. There it was. I had run my fingers over the horse's leg, and it felt like real horse hair. I could not take my eyes off it. It was standing in a little corral with a trough of water. The other thing I noticed was the toy guns with their own double holster. I would have liked to have had that, too. I had showed her just how useful they would be for fending off robbers and pointed out how the caps went in. I already knew a lot about caps and was pretty efficient at peeling the paper off and using a safety pin to take the powder out so I could collect it for other purposes. In the box with the doll, there was a box packed full of tiny garments. There were afternoon dresses and morning dresses and formals and a tutu attached to little tights and a leotard. There was a nightgown and a peignoir set and tiny hats and even little gloves. Anne immediately got them out and displayed them, showing me how she had made them. There were tiny little stitches and perfectly set handmade buttonholes. She had made tiny shoes and even knitted two little sweaters and a coat for the doll, which she told me was named Grace. She held Grace up so I could say hello to her. That was one of those moments when you know you'd better not be spontaneous. Mother had warned me about that before. I knew it would hurt her feelings if I told her what I was thinking, so I smiled, even though it sort of hurt my mouth. One of the dresses was made from the red and white striped material, so Anne said she could match me. I could see that on the doll, the stripes would be much wider, wider than her little face. But Anne kept talking cheerfully. There was a tiny bag for tiny little jacks and a ball. Anne had made those out of twisted wire. The ball was a small bead with a hole filled in and painted. The stripes were so wide that the bag was just red. It actually looked better. I thanked her, holding the doll and looking into its face, thinking that it might be useful as a POW. She hugged me and said we would have fun playing with it together. I don't think she gave one of those garments to Jimmy, but she might have. She gave one to the trash man instead of a tip that year. I really loved Anne. She tried so hard at everything she did, but we did not have much in common even then. Anne loved dressing me in pink dresses and putting little bows in my hair. It was hard to avoid this, and it was the threat of little pink dresses that originally forced me to learn to open all of the windows in the house so I could climb out. Anne wanted to be an artist, Mother told me. She was disappointed that she could not draw, although she could trace things very accurately. Mother said she must have inherited this disposition for not being able to draw from her. Mother could not draw, except either for bunny rabbits, which looked like this. Anne's one successful venture into the arts was her ballet. She'd been taking lessons for years and spent time practicing in the living room. I had watched her occasionally up on her toes and sticking her legs in the air. I never laughed, no matter what she did while practicing. It was just after my birthday that year that she told me she was going to share something very special with me, and it was going to be a surprise. My first thought was that she had decided to get me the holster and pistols. She said that the surprise was waiting for me, and we would go there to get it. I was very excited and had a hard time getting to sleep the night before, and woke up before daylight had started creeping into the bedroom. I sat there in bed thinking about what was going to happen, filled with anticipation. It was Saturday, so Father was home, and he made waffles for breakfast, pouring in the fresh batter into the sizzling waffle iron right there on the table. We all watched the waffles appear like magic from the iron, steaming and smelling like the best ever as Father forked them out onto the plate where they sat before being escorted onto our plates. Father made the best waffles in the world, crispy but still very soft in the middle and brown to that perfect shade of maple that means they are just right. Father made our syrup out of maple lane, so it cost less. Thrift was a virtue, he said. He said it tasted just the same as if a chemist analyzed the content, they would tell us that. Even so, it didn't taste like the maple syrup from a tree, but we all pretended it did. Father liked his syrup hot. Syrup was not allowed on the table unless it was so hot it could melt the butter and ooze into all the crevices with its taste. I liked my waffles slathered with butter so that it melted all the way into the middle. When Stevie turned 4, he started insisting his waffles have every other little cup filled with butter. Then, in alternate ones, he poured the syrup. I could finish eating a whole waffle and then watch him finish getting his ready to eat. Stevie was always methodical. Cappy ate waffles wholesale, putting the butter on all the way across the surface and melting it with warm syrup. The special Saturday, I could hardly finish the first waffle. I was so excited. Anne must have told everyone to help keep the secret, because I could tell they knew, but they weren't going to tell me anything. Cappy had 4 waffles that morning. When he looked at me and smiled a very Cappy smile and said he hoped I enjoyed my little adventure. After the dishes had been cleared and washed, Anne and I got into her baby blue 2-doored Chevy with the immaculate dark blue interior and drove off. I was excited because it looked like we were going to the toy store with the holster and pistols and the Palomino model horse, so I was bouncing a little sitting there on the front seat. I started bouncing a little faster as we neared the driveway to the parking lot. Then we passed it. I stopped bouncing and turned around and watched it recede into the distance, standing on my knees looking over the front seat through the back window. That was when I started to worry a little. I wondered if we were going to the ponies, but then we passed that too. I sat back down watching to see where we were going. Anne was smiling. Finally, we turned into another parking lot at a place I had never been before. There were a lot of cars parked, and girls and women were talking and getting into cars and driving away. I was starting to feel very anxious. When we walked in, I hoped that the surprise was that she wanted me to watch her do some special ballet, because it looked like all these people were carrying the same kind of clothes Anne wore when she practiced. That hope did not last long. Anne had a bag with her that was pink and smaller than her usual bag. She took my hand and led me into a room where a lot of girls were squealing and running around, changing into little versions of the clothes Anne wore when she practiced. I felt kind of numb when she took off my t-shirt and pants and showed me how to pull on the tights and the leotard. Then she added a pink tutu. The other girls kind of stared at us. None of them were wearing a tutu, just tights and a leotard. Most of them were wearing black, too. They all looked at us while they were filing out of the dressing room through another door. The tutu was bright pink. It made my eyes water to look at it. My legs did not feel like they were going to work. I was wobbling when Anne led me through the door. There, all the girls were lined up against the wall with a mirror. They were doing the same things with their arms and legs that Anne did in the living room. Then an older woman clapped her hands, and they all stood still and stared at me some more. The lady stared, too. That was when I burst into tears. No one could get me to stop. I sobbed, standing there. I felt totally and completely humiliated standing there in this pink thing that was a different color than the leotard, that was a different color than the tights. Anne had told me she put them on that she'd gotten them at a special price. The shoes were too big and flopped a little on my feet. So when I turned around and looked at the door to the dressing room, because I was thinking about attempting an escape, I tripped and smacked my nose and forehead on the wood floor. I did not try to get up. I just kept sobbing. Anne must have picked me up and carried me, still crying, into the car and still wearing the tutu. She kept telling me not to embarrass her. I thought, embarrass her? I cried back past the ponies in the toy store onto our street and up into the driveway. I opened the car door as soon as the car stopped rolling and ran in the house, hoping no one would see me. I pulled off the tutu and left it next to the front door. Then I crawled into my little tent in the living room my parents had set up, because I kept getting up all night to sneak in and read my books because I could not sleep. I climbed under the blanket I kept there next to my books, and then the sob started to give out. I felt like a balloon when the air is gone. I just laid there for a while, seeing what it felt like not to be crying. I could hear Mother having a loud discussion with Anne someplace, I think in the living room. Then I went to sleep. I never had to go back to ballet again. When Anne was not working or sewing or doing ballet, she was reading. But that I could understand. I liked books, too. I think Mother was worried that she would never marry because Anne had not had a boyfriend while she was in high school, not even another bookworm with whom she could study. She did not have one for the first 2 years of college, either. And then she met Paul. Paul, and Mother was afraid that there was a chance she would marry. If you knew Paul, you would understand. Paul was very puffed up with himself. He made Anne cry because he pointed out things about her that made her Anne. He wanted her to change so she could make him completely happy. But it was very obvious he never intended to make her happy, and I did not like that. Mother talked to Anne about perhaps joining a convent, but Anne, always practical, pointed out that since we were Congregationalists, that was not a possibility. Paul was the only boyfriend she ever had, which proves that sometimes even a little of something can be too much. I tried to stab him with a fork on their wedding day, but he ducked, and I only got his hand. As it turned out, Paul was worse than we had ever thought possible. Mother always said that the only good that came out of Anne's wedding day was the birth of a litter of kittens that included one kitten that became a family legend. The mommy cat, whose name was Beautiful, decided that the right place for this event was in a box containing the towels embroidered with Anne's new initials, APG. It was from that litter that Pong came into our lives. Pong would live to be 25, an age achieved after living a life full of excitement and adventures past numbering. These included the annihilation of dozens of chipmunks and squirrels and mice that she lined up for inspection at the back door and the birth of two of her own litters for a total of 17 kittens before Father took her in to be fixed. Pong died in my mother's arms with her nose tucked into the crook of Mother's elbow. She had been the first kitten out of the box of towels and the first that Mother picked up. She had tucked her nose into Mother's elbow then, too. If any of us had been confronted with the choice of saving Pong or Paul from a burning building, Paul would have been toast. My own taste in men, disastrous, may well be genetic if my sisters are any indication. And that's probably just as much as we can have from that book today. And I'm really sorry that Edward Griffin was not able to be with us. But I hope that you enjoyed the reading of the book, and through that you've maybe learned a little bit about me and my childhood. And if you're interested in more stories about Jimmy, we're going to be having a show about Jimmy one of these days. And so look for an announcement of that on the site. And that's our show for today, Friday, September 15th, 2006. Here at The Spiritual Politician, what we really do is work to help individuals find ways to unite our spiritual natures with the material world in which we live. Better tools make better relationships. Government is the tool we have mandated to handle a portion of our lives. Where it works, we should continue to use it. Where it causes harm, we must change it. So let me ask you a question. Think about this. Has government done anything today that you wouldn't have done yourself? If you'd taken part in those activities, how would you see yourself now? Because as long as government is doing it, it's being done in our names. To enact change, we all need to do the right thing. And we all know, deep inside ourselves, just what the right thing is. When you think about a choice in your life, and you think about that. You know what the right thing is. And then you make a decision and you do something else all too often, don't you? And when you do that at the second hand and you let government do it for you, well, that's when it can really get bad. So think about that. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure that we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Most of you have heard about the Boston Tea Party. And I want to close by telling you that the group that planned and carried out the Boston Tea Party, the Sons of Liberty, actually still exists. They remained a secret society throughout the Revolution. They had put out their campfires and joined the army. But in 1813, they came together and met again and determined that they would become a fraternal order. And that fraternal order, which is one that you can join today, is the Red Men. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.